Thanks for all showing up on a beautiful day otherwise to hear this perspective. The reason this got developed was I was actually asked to be at twice at the World Economic Forum, which is in the news lately. You may have heard about Vice President Cheney's there now talking about things with political leaders. And they have about 200 scientists, artists, and other invitees amongst the 1,000 people there. And I was asked to say something about energy, and I didn't know much. But I have some credentials. I work with Jose Goldenberg of the World Energy Assessment and the G8 on the technical advisory board of one of the three big supermajor oil companies, BP, Amoco, Arco. I've been to these World Economic Forums, and I've been pretty active in trying to straighten out the key ideas of energy policy by asking questions that a physicist would ask. How much really do we have? When will we use it up? How much left is there to use? What does it cost? And if we need to do something about something like climate mitigation, what's the magnitude of the problem? That sets what the answers can be. So this will not be a Greenpeace kind of on one side and political other right-wing kind of touchy-feely thing. There are numbers. We can decide the numbers are wrong. We can change the numbers. But this will be a numerically based analytical treatment of key questions related to energy. I'll tell you about where we get our power right now and about whether or not there'd ever be a game changer that in our lifetimes might come into play. So we'll predict the future a little bit in a crystal ball. And then see if that's going to come into play, what we would have to do about it, where we could get it from, and if we were to get it, why we can't do that right now, and what the challenges would be. I've worked with Seth Potter, who's an energy economist as well. Actually, he's a scientist, but there are energy economists. Dan Esty was on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, talked to CEOs of several oil companies, done things with the Department of Energy on this. The numbers are all somewhere in peer-reviewed form that I've used, although as you will see with energy, the units are never something friendly, and I've changed that by expressing everything in terms of terawatts. Now, that's the energy unit that you need to worry about. You can think about a terawatt is a mean burn rate, not of electricity, just of the heat content of all the energy sources consumed on the planet. You could also think about it in a unit of exajoules of heat equivalent from these sources consumed per year. If you're interested, the magic conversion from terawatts to exajoules is 31. Is the way it numerically works out. So if you wanted to express it in exajoules per year, you can multiply my units by 31. If you take the mean burn rate, as these are, of all the energy on the planet right now in 1998, my numbers aren't perfectly contemporaneous, so excuse me for that, but they're when I can last find them compiled. We burned as a planet 13 terawatts worth of primary energy. The lion's share of that came from oil, gas, and coal, 85%. The U.S., by the way, of course, well known, consumes a quarter of the world's energy. It's often expressed in 99 quads, which is quadrillion BTU. But if you take a quadrillion BTU and you divide that by the number of seconds in a year, it's 3 terawatts. Okay, so I will only talk in terawatts. And if you also try to figure this out, there's BTUs of coal and cubic feet of natural gas at standard pressure, and then there's barrels of oil equivalent. But when you put it all into doing the math, that's what the numbers are on that watt scale. We have some significant fractions from hydro, biomass, and this is not renewable biomass. This is mostly biomass unsustainably burnt, where we deforest at a rate much faster than nature will reestablish that mass. The renewable portion of biomass is in the total renewables column, and then there's nuclear. For those of you that know, this is all the primary heat produced by nuclear power, and of course, you have about a 3-to-1 conversion loss when you convert that to electricity. So the global electric, which is secondary power, is a different number than these primary powers because, of course, we choose to convert a lot of coal to electric at a 3-to-1 penalty. So this isn't discounted for any way you convert that energy into secondary energy. This is primary energy consumed and the heat content of all the primary energy consumed globally. Okay. And what about renewables? Well, since that'll be a little focus of this, as you'll see later on, I think it's important to establish that we need a log scale in order to even see them. The total biomass contribution is about a tenth of a terawatt, roughly equally divided between electricity, heat, and then mostly in Brazil, ethanol. There's wind, 10 to minus 3rd terawatts, solar photovoltaic, 10 to minus 5. So we hear a lot about it. It's a part in a million of our total energy consumption right now. And then some other small players, solar thermal, hydro, geo, marine, things like that. Right. Maybe this will change naturally. So let's ask the question. First of all, how much do these things cost? Now, this is production costs as 2002. Actually, their annual levelized cost between 2001 and 2004. There's a range here because it includes both marginal costs on the short run as well as long run costs. I don't want to get into that too much. But there are two important points. One is that, of course, almost all the domestic coal in the United States is used to make electricity. Coal is the cheapest source of electricity. All, in general, fossil energy is the cheapest source of electricity. And then wind is about 5 to 7 cents a kilowatt hour in favorable siting, where you don't bear the full cost because it's an intermittent source and you don't bear the storage penalty to do that. You just feed it into the grid at peak when it's there. Nuclear has been estimated, although you'll see costs that are 2 to 3 cents. The most recent study by the Deutsche panel at MIT has estimated for new construction at scale on the order of about 1,000 plants. You could then potentially lower the cost to 6 to 7 cents a kilowatt hour fully amortized for nuclear. And solar is up here of 25 cents in very favorable siting to 50 cents or a dollar or higher for per kilowatt hour. So clearly, you would have to come down to even make electricity at this price. But there's another very important feature about this. Electricity is high-value energy, and only 10%, in fact, the United States consumption of electricity was only 3/10 of a terawatt out of the 3 terawatts that we consume globally. Electricity is high-value energy. And in fact, if you look at a nickel a kilowatt hour, and you convert that into dollars per gigajoule of energy, you find that a nickel a kilowatt hour is high value energy. You pay a penalty, a premium, to convert fossil energy into electricity. And so if you want to compete on a dollar per joule basis on energy with fossil energy, you have to lower not to a nickel a kilowatt hour, but by another factor of 5 or so. This is often confused because electricity is high up in the value chain, and we only use it where we absolutely need that high value energy. At some point, as I'll say, a joule is a joule. And if you're heating your house, it's foolish to convert 3 joules of coal into a joule of electricity, pump it down a wire, and then burn those joules again, as opposed to getting them in the first place. Yeah?
When you speak of costs, for example, with nuclear, are you including the issue of long-term?
No. The waste and long-term disposal is not included in this analytically. Right?
Coal,
everything else, unless you're sequestered, these are costs right now to do what we do with those sources, right? Okay, it's not going to be a big issue in my big picture anyway, as you'll see. Okay, because I'm not going to make an argument based on a factor of 20 or 30% or an incremental cost advantage of one energy supply versus another. That's not the spirit of where I'm going here. So let's not dwell on that. Well, I will make arguments on factor of 5 or 10. Okay, so. What you don't want to do is produce energy at 7 cents a kilowatt hour and say you're going to run your cars off of that by making hydrogen, because that's very expensive hydrogen as an equivalent to what you would have done at $2 a gigajoule instead of $14 a gigajoule electric, and then bearing a conversion penalty, you're making that energy at 10 times more of the price than you pay right now for fossil energy. Okay? You might wish to pay that price, but that's what we would be talking about. And let's see. So. Maybe this will change. Maybe this will change because we'll start to run out. Well, we can do that too. We can take the proven reserves and the resource base. The proven reserves are things that we know statistically with whatever sigma bound 90% confidence exist in the ground. And then the resource base is something that we have 50% confidence about. What I've done is taken the proven reserves and the additional resource base and divided by the burn rate yearly to project out how many years we have left at our current burn rates. And in fact, depending on whether you include unconventional like tar sands and other resources for oil and methane, and not include the methane clath rates, which are controversial that you could release them in coal, what you see is that at current burn rates, we have between 40 and 80 years proven reserves of oil. We have between 60 and 176 years of natural gas and 200 years of coal. There are several other important points about this. One, this is often referred to by people who say, we're going to run out of oil. There is always about 40 years worth of proven reserves. The reason is that oil exploration costs about $1 million a day to do a well drill. And you explore and budget enough to give yourself a buffer of about 40 years, and then you stop exploring. And so there almost always has been 40 years worth of proven reserves at any point in time. What matters more is the resource base, how much we think there is. Furthermore, half of the oil that already has been discovered has been left in the ground because it's uneconomical to pump out those, and I'm not counting that. Okay? So we have roughly between 50 and 150 years at current burn rates of the resource base of oil. We have between 200 and 600 years of natural gas. We have probably about between 1,000 and 3,000, 2,000 years worth of coal. Okay? So we have ample proven reserves to last us for quite a long time if we choose to do it. The other point is that if we ran out of oil, and of course there are important geopolitical dimensions to domestic U.S. supply versus other regional supplies of oil, but if this is fossil fungible in the big picture. These are all carbon-containing fossil sources, and if we ran out of oil and were deprived of it globally, we could convert coal into oil. Germany did it in World War II. It costs about 30% on the margin to do that, so it's uneconomical to do that now compared to pumping oil out of the ground and putting it in a tanker and delivering it to where we need to. But if deprived of oil, we have ample fossil energy reserves to power our planet. Okay? So, I haven't talked about uranium yet, but we will talk about nuclear and uranium supply later. Okay? What's clear is on a joule basis, we have an abundant, inexpensive resource base of fossil fuels. So Economics 101 says renewables and, if you're going to use nuclear at 7 cents a kilowatt hour to make primary power, it's not going to play a large role unless you get a technological cost breakthrough by a factor of 5 or 10 to compete on a joule basis with that energy, or there are unpriced externalities that would be introduced. For instance, we don't want to pay the price of greenhouse types of issues. Okay. So this is controversial. I get half the people already upset. But this is an analytical argument based on numbers. Okay. Well, I'll try to go ahead and change the picture a little bit. You know, we have to look in the future. Yeah, I know. What other kind of predictions are there? Some physicists will say Niels Bohr said it. It turns out I've traced it back to Shakespeare. The British told me that. It probably goes back beyond that, but I'm a baseball fan, so we'll quote Yogi. Nevertheless, there are about 100 papers on sustainability. I'm going to summarize the issues as related in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 92 report that's been updated a little more recently. To tell you what, now I certainly believe, and most people believe, if there will be a game changer that will not let us burn those fossil fuels, even though we have them in our most inexpensive and abundant resource, what that would be. So let's try to project out how much energy we'll need, and you'll see this scenario. It's convenient to break down energy demand and conventionally done in the so-called Kaya equation with three terms. One is people, because people and their standard of living are the drivers for energy consumption. This is a century scale plot. Here's the 1900s, here's the 2000s of energy of population on the planet. We're 5.5 billion people, you can estimate. And my favorite out date here is the mid-21st century, 2050. So we'll think about that number. Well, it'll be about 10 billion people, maybe 9 billion, but certainly more than there are now on the planet. Instead of that, just multiplying the number of people by the energy consumption per capita, we need to break that down into two separate factors. One is the per capita GDP growth, which is globally average, been growing at about 1.6% per year. And the second is the energy consumption per unit of GDP. And in fact, that's been declining. That's been declining at 1% per year. Now, the United States is actually doing better than that. We're about 2% per year declining. And the world average is 1% because, of course, the non-industrialized countries are industrializing. So they're growing their consumption per unit of GDP, balancing by our decline to about 1% globally. For your information, the present administration has committed to continue its on historical path of doing twice as well as the world average, which is something we hope that we can continue to do.
Is that a consequence of efficiency or shift in the balance of
economic? Well, I actually don't want to get into that, but it's got both factors in it, right? It's balance of services plus the economy plus energy savings is economical in many cases, right? The reason I want to break this down this way is twofold. Number one, all end-use demand issues are built into this. Energy conservation is built into the fact that we're going to continue, we hope, to globally use energy more efficiently at a rate of 1% per year. So improvements in fuel cells and residential home heating and everything else is built into that number. If you believe that this will go down by 1% per year or 2%, it's actually irrelevant to the argument because we'll have some, we hope, global economic growth, and this offsets that. And total demand is obviously the product of people times per capita GDP growth times energy consumption per unit of GDP is the product of these three. And so no matter what scenario you typically will come out, it's pretty simple. Twice as many people are going to use twice as much energy, more or less. Nobody believes that you could use flat energy in the presence of population doubling in 50 years. Okay? So a very optimistic assumption is that even with very aggressive global conservation, we will still need at least as much and probably more energy than we use now. Whether or not it's twice as much or 50% more isn't the issue. Right? You're not going to conserve yourself down off of our base now by a factor of 5. Okay? That's the big picture issue. Right? Now this math, which is pretty much agreed upon by most economists, although you can vary in the exact numerical numbers here, but I don't want to dwell on that. But if you take this number as an example, then you project onto this curve of what energy consumption will be in 2050, and it'll be about twice as big as it is now. Depends on your exact choice, but it's dominated by population growth. If you let economic productivity be a little bit higher than demand decline in conservation, then you end up with a little bit more than a factor of 2, but it's somewhere between 20 and 30 terawatts, because twice as many people will use about twice as much energy. And we can get all that energy from fossil energy. All we have to do is divide my out-burn rate years by 2, because we'd be using twice as much, and instead of 2,000 years of coal, we have 1,000 years of coal. Okay? But it's still quite a long time. Okay? Well, we need a couple more facts. Fact one is let's look at the carbon intensity, the amount of carbon grams or gigatons per terawatt year, awful units. Just think about the amount of carbon produced into the per unit of energy extracted from these various sources globally. And we've naturally, on average, as a society, gone to less and less carbon intensive energy sources. Wood is the most carbon intensive. You emit the most carbon per useful extracted joule of energy produced by burning wood, then coal, then oil, and then natural gas in the fossil energies. And of course, for the non-chemists out here, when you burn CH4, you make one CO2 and two H2Os, and so you get a lot of the heat from making water and not as much from making CO2. When you burn coal, which is all carbon, all you get is CO2. And that's the fundamental chemical basis for coal being the most carbon, oil being carbon to hydrogen about 1 to 2, and natural gas being 1 to 4 as to why this is. Okay? And we've naturally evolved down this curve. Now, what the IPCC said was what I consider to be an extremely personally optimistic assumption. They assumed that we would continue over the next 50 years along this historical carbon intensity trend, so that by 2050, the mean intensity of the energy mix in carbon on the planet would be lower than that of the least carbon intensive of all of the fossil energy sources. Okay? Now, we need to go with this assumption to go to the next step, because if you don't make this assumption, this is a lower bound on what the carbon emissions will be, because we're under this optimistic assumption right now. Okay? Now, if we do this, they just drew a straight line through the historical basis. Now, that's a perfectly reasonable. If you don't know the future, we will draw a straight line through the past to predict the future. What other basis is there?
So when the rest of you predict the new source,
better than that. Let's get to this. All right. So what's clear? What's clear is you will immediately see that to get the mean value lower than that of the least carbon intensive, of the least fossil energy sources we have, you better have something with zeros in them. Right? Furthermore, to the extent that the consumed fossil energy mix is not entirely natural gas, but is, say, equal parts of coal, oil, and gas, roughly mimicking what we do now, then you need even more zero to bring the mean value down to there.
Okay? Question.
Yeah.
You You said all your curves are well averaged, right? But if you were to plot these curves, say, for the U.S. and China, would they look very, very different?
We have different resource bases. China has a lot more. These curves?
Yeah.
They would look somewhat different, but this is all globally averaged. It's hard to predict what will happen in the future because, of course, China and the United States both have tremendous reserves domestically of coal. And if they choose to exploit that, we have a $4 billion clean coal initiative. There is, from a greenhouse gas point of view, that's completely oxymoronic. Right? There's no such thing as clean coal. Right? Because the physics and chemistry says that coal makes CO2 more intensively than oil and gas, even if you clean up the SOx and NOx. If we choose to exploit that, which would be a logical thing to exploit if you didn't have to mitigate carbon emissions because we have a domestic abundancy of that resource, that's one path. If we're forced to not exploit it for this externality, there's another decision path to be made. Okay? So I don't want to do that extrapolation because there are regional issues involved, but the key decision point is whether or not you have to mitigate. Okay?
Around the year 2000.
Right.
Is that part of projection or something we've actually seen? Something we've seen, what is it?
Yeah, I don't actually personally know what. I haven't looked at that in too much detail. Right. You could say maybe I should have drawn a line right there. Let me tell you one more thing, which I do know. Although we've gone down this curve, it's been the case, interestingly, that we have never as a planet used less in any year N relative to the year N minus 1 in absolute terms of any energy source. We've never used less nuclear than we produced in the year before. We've never used less oil. We've never used less coal. We've never used less wood than we've ever used in the year before. So even wood, on an absolute basis, because there are more people, we burn more of everything in every year than we ever did in the preceding year, no matter what quantity you plot. All right. So look, we know demand, right? We know demand, and we know the mean carbon intensity, and therefore we know mathematically what the carbon emissions will be. So we can plot that under this optimistic scenario, right? So this is why I didn't want to dwell on demand much, because if you believe demand would maybe be flat in a very optimistic scenario, that would probably be counteracted by the fact that it's hard to believe that you could meet this optimistic carbon intensity, and so within, again, the 30% arguments, those two things will cancel, and so we don't need to dwell on them. Okay? So why don't you look at the top curve here, and that's what the carbon emissions will be as a result of if we meet those intensity projections with that demand. Now, we know that because that's simply arithmetic, and we know the carbon budget well enough to know what will appear in the atmosphere. And that curve is the top curve here, the so-called business-as-usual curve by the IPCC. So that was business-as-usual somehow, that we were going to lower the mean carbon intensity below that of the least carbon-intensive source on average in 50 years. And if we did that, we would be up here on this curve, which leads to give you a feeling for that. These are the curves that would result if you wanted to stabilize the atmospheric concentration at the numerical value so indicated in ppm. The pre-industrial levels are about 275 ppm. To stabilize at 350 ppm, you would need to have no carbon at all emissions in 50 years. To get to 550, you would have to be more aggressive than those aggressive scenarios that I told you about already. And this curve, the business as usual curve, was up at 750 and rising. Now, we know this will be the case arithmetically, because we know the consequences of emitting carbon to the atmosphere. We don't know the climate consequences analytically of putting that concentration of CO2 into the atmosphere. That's where the risk comes in. But we know this will happen. Okay? Today's value is about 310, something like that. So in my personal opinion, 350 looks hopeless. 550 probably, in fact, if you ask people who are thinking about the CO2 doubling scenarios of why are you picking doubling, which is where climate modelers will argue over whether or not the mean temperature will be 1 or 2 degrees C rise, almost nobody that does the modeling, to the extent that we can believe its predictions, believes that the Earth will be a very similar place to the way it is now at 750. at a tripling level. And the reason the 550 has been said is because that's something that we would hope that beyond what we could possibly envision, we might possibly have a shot at stabilizing towards, not necessarily the desired value. Okay? Nobody believes you could ever get to 350, even if the model said that's where we had to be. The other issue is, would we ever believe robustly a century-level computer model with maybe 50 years worth of calibration data 50 years out to do something about it? The other way to think about that is to say, what's the deficit that you need in carbon-free power in order to lie on any one of those curves in 50 years? Okay. So this is just the arithmetic part of rearranging the equation to figure out how much carbon-free is needed to meet that mean value and to lie on that curve. And what you see is the business-as-usual scenario had 10 terawatts to meet that mean optimistic scenario of carbon-free power with roughly equal parts oil, coal, and gas in 50 years. And to stabilize further, you need more than that. Another way of saying that is that if we want to even stay at 750 ppm, we need to make as much power from carbon-free sources as 50 years as we consume from all energy sources today combined. Okay? So that's the challenge. All right. So what they said, Marty Hoffert and Seth Potter, when they wrote this paper underscoring these curves in Nature, was these underscore the pitfalls of wait and see. We don't have any cost signals. There are no economic drivers to develop these technologies. And even if we did them in 30 years, we couldn't capitalize them to the scale commensurate with the biggest business on Earth, the energy business, in 2050. And maybe we need a Manhattan Project or an Apollo space program to do something about this. Well, I have a little different take on it. If we need such amounts of carbon-free power, which are clearly linked to the risk that we would have to mitigate, and this is a risk, which is an insurance policy. That's the way I think we need to view it. We don't know absolutely we will have to mitigate, and we don't know absolutely we won't. And depending on your order of magnitude, probably the reasonable guess is that it's 50-50. It may be 60-40 or 70-30 or 30-70, but it's not 1 in 10 and it's not 10 in 1, although you can get the various viewpoints of the spectrum. But it's probably something like maybe we will, maybe we won't. You can make it probably we will or probably we won't, but it's certainly not definitely yes or no. And so insurance to be bought must be an R&D to somehow try to figure out how we could make enough carbon-free power if we so chose on a timescale of the mid-21st century. Okay? And therefore, energy pricing currently isn't the driver for thinking about that. We'd better figure out what the energy potential of the various forms of not renewable, carbon-free energy, doesn't have to be renewable, but it has to be free of carbon to get that mean value down. And then I'll tell you about the technologies and costs of various carbon-free sources. I need to change that slide. And then the impact of if we did that on the distribution system. So there are three general scenarios. The first one is nuclear, fission and fusion. This is, of course, the only scalable technology that we now have that could meet that 10 terawatt order of magnitude carbon-free power. Let's set the scale of the problem. Nuclear power plants are now about a gigawatt. They're sized that way because that's about the good scaling for handling the thermal properties of this, essentially point sources of heat. If you wanted to build 10 terawatts, you would have to be building one new nuclear reactor every other day continuously somewhere in the world for 50 years. Right? Okay. This is technically doable, and we should not discount it. The way I like to say this, though, is if we do nothing else and we have to mitigate, then this is the legacy we'll leave for our kids. Right? I mean, that's it. This is what we'll have for them. We do have ample reserves. It turns out if you look at the terrestrial source base of uranium at this scale, there's only 10 years worth of energy before we burnt it, but you could get it from seawater for about 700 years, so we would have ample uranium without going to breeder reactors. There are issues about waste and just about general comfort level of this scale. We're worried about one in North Korea. You know, there are issues like that, but technically, this is the scale that if we chose to mitigate greenhouse gases, to get to that mean burn rate, which still doesn't stabilize at 550, it still gets us something like 750, this is the scale we would have to be contemplating.
How many nuclear reactors are there in front?
400 total, 432 have the total worldwide ever.
432 total.
Total, worldwide ever. We haven't commissioned a new one in 30 years in the United States. I've been giving this talk for 2 years. The way I like to say this is we should have already built 300 nuclear power plants. The second way to think about this is to take that fossil energy, which we have ample reserves of, and sequester it. And then the third is use carbon-free sources. Carbon sequestration has been looked at in some detail. It is still an option that definitely, in my opinion, should be pursued. There are three general places you could put all that CO2. 1.5 gigatons per year of CO2 would have to be sequestered at current burn rates. Projection might be 6 gigatons per year is total global emissions. And you could put it in the oceans. People have discredited that now mostly as being desirable because of pH changes of putting CO2 into the oceans and changing the ecosystem. You could put it where it ultimately ends up in the carbonates and in the crust, but that would be an accelerated weathering that has very high energetic penalty to do it, to get it over that barrier. No one knows how to do that. And so the only probably viable contender at this point is to put it in the underground aquifers, into the geologic reservoirs that we're pumping out, say, natural gas from now, and just fill it up with supercritical CO2 instead and let it dissolve in the brine. That's technically, in principle, an option that we don't know will work. Here's where the basins are, where you could have capacity. There would be roughly, if we exploited them all, an estimate of 50 years worth of total sequestration capacity at current fluxes, at which point we would run out of sequestration capacity, maybe 100 years. We could, in principle, do this, if it works technically. Right? It should be explored. There are two facts that you need to know. The first fact is, which I wish I could superimpose, and if someone's a PowerPoint expert, they can help me do it. The next map is a map of where all the current power plants are in the United States, and that's where the reservoirs that sequestering them are. And you can't transport the CO2 over distance because it becomes prohibitively expensive to pump it. So you would have to co-locate or rebuild all those power plants that aren't on those maps in order to effectively sequester it.
Okay. And what pressure?
Now, this is going to dissolve in the underground brine, in the aquifers. Now, there's another issue. The issue is all reservoirs leak at some level. There are 1 million holes in Texas alone from oil drilling, right? Over 1 million holes. If you have a mean leak rate, I don't need to tell you this, of 2%, you've sequestered for 50 years, you're back to where you started. So the mean leak rate has to be on the order of about 0.1% for hundreds of years or more time scale to have this actually be a viable technical option that we would adopt in the mid-21st century. Okay? Technically, we can't and shouldn't rule out this as an option. And if you believe that you would use fossil energy and coal primarily domestically, and you would have to sequester, then what can you pump? You can only pump around for distribution protons or electrons. And then you are driven to pumping around either electricity to distribute to end users or hydrogen. So in my opinion, the driver behind the hydrogen economy, as I'll speak more later, is this scenario that we're sequestering our fossil energy resources as coal because we have to supply the energy to the end user in a carbon-free fashion. So the third general class is renewables. Renewables take five forms in general: hydro, geothermal, wind, biomass, and solar. And I'll go through briefly each and spend a little more time for obvious reasons on solar later on. Let me comment that I'm personally agnostic about which numbers turn out to be big and small here, and people don't like it when I pick winners and losers. But that's exactly what I'm going to do. If you look at the total hydro potential on the planet, hydro is a model renewable. Sure, if you build the Three Gorges Dam in China, you have to displace 1 million people and some fish die. But relative to other things, that's not that big an impact. So it's generally a model renewable. And it's the cheapest, if you remember, electric source. And so people say on the margins we should just do renewables with hydroelectric. Well, if you add up the hydroelectric potential of every river, lake, and stream in the world, it's worth 4.6 terawatts.
Are you assuming any about the oceans as a potential hydroelectric source?
No, I haven't assumed. I would call that marine. All right, so nothing to do with tides and nothing to do with thermal heat engines in the oceans.
Have you looked at that?
Yeah. So a marine is very diffuse in tides, and the heat engine delta T's are pretty low, and so unless you cover extremely large areas, I mean prohibitively large areas, they don't work out.
Well, lunch there was this mention about building a dam at Gibraltar.
Yeah, well, let's get there. But the total hydro potential is 4.6 terawatts, where it's technically feasible terrestrially. You know, you can't dam up every river, lake, and stream. They flow too slowly. Where you actually could do it technically is 1.5 terawatts globally. But you can't dam up the Hudson River, even if you technically wanted to do so, because then the Yankees couldn't win the World Series. And so, you know, 0.9 terawatts is where you could economically do it. And the installed capacity is already 0.6 terawatts. Because it's pretty cheap, we've already done it most of the places you can do it globally. Okay? Our actual production is only about half of the capacity, because, of course, you don't have water flowing at its maximum velocity all the time of the year. And so that's always going to be the case, that we're going to lag in total produced volume compared to what you could theoretically do if they're running at 100% capacity all the time. But this is the potential that you would have economically feasible at 100% capacity. Hydro is a good thing to do, but it won't get you 10 terawatts, or even close. Okay. What about geothermal? Well, you see geothermal, 1.3 gigawatts, not terawatts, the units are right, capacity 1985. There are two general classes. One of the hydrothermal systems where nature's kind to us and the temperature at the surface is hot enough to just give us steam, and you can just run a turbine with the steam that comes out, like here in the geysers in California. But those are few and far between on a real energy scale. And in fact, the only real potential would be to drill down to about 10-kilometer depth in well pairs where you injected cold water, let it flow through the rock, heat up, and then come out and ran a heat engine-driven turbine that way. You would have to go to about 10 kilometers. There are interesting things about this. One is, this is a map of where the temperatures are near the surface, of course, Yellowstone and geothermal areas, but most of it you have to go down deep. You need to know a few things as a physicist. One is the mean terrestrial geothermal flux. The Earth's surface is only 57 milliwatts per meter squared. And so independent of the delta T difference in the actual heat engine numbers, that would require at 100% efficiency extraction covering all the continent. It's all on the planet. Okay. You can get more if you go down deep. But this is not completely renewable, because you're pumping in cold water and extracting the heat out of that rock. And the thermal conduction then would not be able to match that flux eventually. And so the geothermal wells run out of steam in about 5 years. You every 5 years have to drill a new well pair somewhere. The power from a good geothermal well pair is about 5 megawatts, whereas comparison, the flux in a mean Saudi oil well is about 500 megawatts. So we need an awful lot of those wells, right? Dug deeply. And it turns out that when you analyze the cost to yield you that much power, you would need a breakthrough in drilling technology that took drilling from exponential with depth to linear with depth, and nobody really has a clue how to do that, no less how to drill all those wells. What about wind? You see maps like this. In fact, you hear, in fact, the New York Times had a misquoted number of there's enough wind potential to supply all the nation's power if you just covered North Dakota. Well, the real answer is twofold. One, if you look on the NREL website, you will see that if indeed you covered windmills at 5% spacing, they extrapolated that you could make 36% of the nation's electricity, not our total power, electricity out of North Dakota, 24% of the South Dakota. The electric power in 1990 was 0.39 terawatts. So you could make on the order of half a terawatt. This is an optimistic assumption, however, because these were in the independent windmill assumption, where they calculated what the energy would be as if one windmill were a point and the other windmill were a point and multiplied them by the area of North Dakota, never accounting for the fact that the wind downstream of any individual windmill, which sucks 40% of the energy that hits it out into electricity, will shield the next one. Okay. So the skin depth makes this a gross upper limit on how much wind potential there actually is. Nevertheless, taking those numbers, and it turns out in the United States, 6% of land for wind energy could be developed. The practical potential, probably an upper bound, is half a terawatt. Theoretically, 27% of the Earth's land surface is so-called class 3, having a mean wind speed, while the velocity cubed weighted, because the potential energy in a flowing fluid goes like it's It's kinematic density times the velocity cubed. So cubed weighted turns out to be class 3, 27% of the Earth's surface. If you used it all, you would get a few terawatts practically, terrestrially. There's more in the ocean, but you would have to find ways to deploy very large-scale windmill farms in over very large areas in the ocean economically and then get the power back to where we need it on land. Right? But terrestrially, there's only about 2 terawatts. The other point about wind is don't count on the cost, the fact that it supplies energy now into the grid as opposed to storing it. The grid stores nothing. The grid is just a bunch of wires that provide that, and their peak power is what windmills are doing, not baseload power. You would have to store that, so you got it when the wind wasn't there. It turns out that the grid can handle about 20% of intermittent power without changing the structure of the grid, but you would have to redo the whole electric grid to do this, and furthermore, you would have to actually find some storage system to count in the costs. Probably the proposal, the best way to do that is to on-site at every windmill to buffer the load by having a compressed air piston that then yielded baseload power out, and the penalty for that's about a penny a kilowatt hour estimate on large scale. And so there's a mechanism to do it, but probably not enough resource space to get to the 10 terawatt order of magnitude. What about biomass? Biomass, let's look two ways, bottom up and top down. Plants are simply inefficient energy conversion machines. They should be black and not green if they really wanted to harness most of the photon energy. But nature worked with carbon and hydrogen, and it's good enough to what nature had to do. But if you take that, 0.3% is the number that the fundamental photosynthetic reaction center scales in terms of total energy incident on a plant from 0 EV all the way through the ultraviolet, divided as the denominator, and then the numerator is how much energy is stored in the sugar that you actually produce by photosynthesis in that plant, and that turns out to be 0.3%. So it's a simple calculation to know the mean insulation, and if you want 20 terawatts, that's 31% of the total land mass of the Earth you would have to cover with plants. Okay. Let's do it bottom up. Well, we can take all the area we could actually grow plants in 1990. That's 2.45 times 10 to the third square meters. We have to subtract off where we're growing it now to feed us, and subtract off about half again, improving agricultural efficiency to feed 9 billion people instead of 5 billion people. And then we'll take all the difference where we could grow crops, where we don't grow them now to feed us, and take that all for assuming we have big energy farms. With the best known growing biomass, which is switchgrass, basically. I've heard hemp as a suggestion, but it's not as good as switchgrass, actually. And a very optimistic value of what you can get in heat by burning that, 20 gigajoules heating value per dry ton. By the way, corn is not even break-even in the United States, so it's a complete misnomer. You would only do corn for political reasons, not for energy reasons. It takes more energy into the farm to fertilize the farm and to grow it and to get the corn than the energy you get out is heat from the corn. Experience shows that if you do switchgrass, the net is about 85% on some large scales of the gross. I've assumed that 100% of the gross is the net, and there's no energy input into the farms at all. And then if you did that globally on all the land where you could water and grow crops, you could get 10 terawatts. Okay? That assumes gross equals net. It further assumes that you have enough fresh water and you don't expend any energy making fresh water from seawater to water and grow all those crops. And you expend no energy to extract at all. Biomass should be taken seriously, however, because it does have the order of magnitude right at some level to be commensurate with the scale of the problem. Okay. The last calibration point is, what's the solar constant? Well, the solar constant turns out to be in these units 10 to the 5th terawatts. Okay. Correcting for the albedo, it's 1.2 times 10 to the 5th terawatts worth of potential. Terrestrially, numbers, depending on how conservative you are for sighting, vary from between 50 and 1500. I think a pretty good number is somewhere in the middle, like all things, about 600 terawatts mean potential. And if you had 10% day-night average, that'd be about 60 terawatts. For a calibration, photosynthesis runs the planet right now at 90 terawatts. Right? So clearly it's the only big number here. Well, if we're going to put something like, and I don't think it would be photovoltaics, and I'll tell you why not, so I want to get rid of that misconception right off the bat, but if you need to put something there as a converter to take solar photons and make useful energy out of them somehow, well, maybe you're going to do something with the heat. Well, it turns out that's a thing to think about, but unless it's co-located for home heating, not very useful, because if you want to do the solar market, the total market right now for space heating is only a terawatt, for crop drying is pretty small, but the important point is there's a big temporal mismatch, except in California in the summer, between when you get solar energy and when you need it. We need it to run our air conditioners in the summer, but almost all of the times you get it in a day, you need it at night, you get it in the summer, you need it at winter to heat your houses. The energy demand is consumption is actually broken down into four major sectors about equally. One is industrial, to make the things that run us, our lives. One is residential and light industrial. That's about a quarter. The third is a quarter is transportation, and the fourth is a quarter is transformation of converting one form of energy into another form of energy. Right. Well, if you wanted to do this at a 10% efficiency, then it's an easy calculation to do on the mean insulation. Here's a map. That's a 3 terawatt map at 10% net efficiency. So that's the size of an area you would need to cover at a typical mid-latitude. This isn't in Arizona in the summertime kind of calculations. It's a 200 watt per meter squared mean day-night averaged yearly averaged insulation number. It's a good, honest number. Gives you a feeling for the scale. This is not small. I don't mean to say this is small, but on the other hand, I've never talked to an audience where anybody's ever lived there. Does anybody live there? Oh, one person, okay. So, all right. You would never actually do it this way, of course, because you do it more locally, but it gives you a feeling for the scale. Here's 6 3-terawatt boxes, right? Middle East has a lot of sun. We can do that if we needed to. But let's look at the scale really, just to not deceive people here. You can ask Jeeves how many single-family homes are in the United States. You can figure out each home has about a mean value of 2,000 square feet per roof. It's 10 times bigger than covering everybody's roof on the whole country. That's the area needed. Now, the reason for that is you'll also often hear the misconception that you could, if you had a nice home, the truth, that if you had a nice thermally and electrically efficient home, provide all the power that home consumed from solar panels at 10% on the roof. That's all the electric power of that home consumed and maybe the thermal power. But we consume per capita, to run our lives, 10 times more than that we consume in our houses because we drive cars, airplanes run to service us, industries make products that consume energy that we buy. And so this turns out to be 10 times bigger in land area to meet primary energy consumption than covering everybody's rooftop. Okay? It's comparable in area to all the highway area in the United States. Not the interstate highway area, all the highway area. Okay. So there are three ways you could think about doing that. Personally, I think that looks a lot better in area basis, at least, than covering all the inhabitable parts of the earth where we could grow crops with probably what would be, I like to call them Franken crops, right? Because they would have to be black, not green. And we can't even adopt genetically modified organisms now to feed ourselves, no less to cover all the rest of the earth to power ourselves. But that's one way. We could modify plants to cover smaller areas and become black instead of green, and that would reduce the area content of them. Or we can make electricity with photovoltaics, but that's, I told you already, not a solution, because it's only 10% of our end use and you can't store it. Or we can make fuel. I personally work on one way to do that, but that's incidental to the whole talk. We hear a lot about solar. It's a part in a million. It's growing, but it's highly subsidized. In fact, the important point is that there are about 5 technologies that are being developed, and companies that are developing them can't generally decide between them. Why is that? The reason that is because they all lie on the figure of merit on this common cost per watt basis. They all lie in about here. They cost installed about $300 a square meter. And if you amortize that out, and they last for 30 years, as to all the power you made, and you value that electricity as a nickel a kilowatt hour, and you figure out all the kilowatt hours that you converted for those 30 years worth of insulation, and you divide that into the cost per square meter to install it, it amortizes out to about 30 cents a kilowatt hour, and you now pay a nickel a kilowatt hour in cost for fossil energy-derived electricity. And so on a cost per watt basis, everything's in zone one. There are clearly two ways to get around that, and there's a way not to get around it. The way not to get around it is to say that I'm going to improve the efficiency and do it that way. Because if you've got to get down not to compete with electricity in a nickel a kilowatt hour, but compete with fossil energy at five times lower than that, then you have to get down by a factor of on the order of 50, and you obviously can't do that with just efficiency improvements, although cold fusion tried, but you know, we can't do that. Okay. So there are two ways you could get there, with high efficiency and moderate cost, or with moderate efficiencies and really low costs. To give you a feeling, you might get there with something like on the order of $10, $20 a square meter installation costs. The price of paint at Home Depot is about $1 a square meter. Okay, so it could cost you 5 or 10 times as much as maybe at most as painting your house, but not more than that. Okay? So there are two reasons why you can't do that right now. One is that photovoltaics have come out of the solid-state physics discovery at Bell Labs, for instance, and of course it's great science and technology. They require single crystals because the absorption depth of materials is fixed, and you have to have a thick enough sample to absorb all the sunlight or you waste photons. But once it's absorbed, it has to make it to a planar junction, and therefore that sets the purity of the material that is required to get that excited state to last long enough by diffusion or drift to be collected and separated at the chemically dissimilar contact, so it knows the left side from the right side and can yield the current asymmetrically in the circuit. Right? And when you make small grain-sized materials, then the photogenerated carriers get hung up at the grain boundaries because they know that those atoms are different chemically than the ones in the bulk. They're not in the periodic potential of the crystal anymore, and so the cheap materials don't work very well, and the expensive ones work well, and they are about the same cost per watt. Organic materials, organic photovoltaics are inherently disordered, and so although they're cheap, they inherently have a short lifetime, and they have about the same cost per watt. Okay. So you can't get off the curve. I can see two ways in principle to get off that curve. One is actual chemistry problem. There is no law of physics that says that carriers must recombine at grain boundaries, and you can't make solar paint, that you can't fool particles into thinking that they're a single crystal by chemically terminating the surface atoms to fool them into thinking that they're atoms in the bulk. This is a chemical bonding issue. Right? So people like myself are working on that. The other issue is a topographic one. The constraint was that you had to have a planar junction where the carriers had to live long enough and material be pure enough to live for a certain thickness to get to the back planar junction. But that need not be the case if I can make interpenetrating networks of two dissimilar phases, so that instead of having to travel the full longitudinal distance, they can travel axially and then be collected into this dissimilar junction. And by the ratio of the axial to longitudinal, you relax the materials constraint. So these are both kind of fundamental approaches that might yield ways to get off that cost per watt curve. Let me not get into that. On the other hand, you often see this from in fact, I lifted it from the Department of Energy's website, of what we will do in a hydrogen economy is take all the solar and wind and biomass and feed them all into a fuel processor, and we're going to make hydrogen as the fuel and run it in a fuel cell and be done with it. There are several points about this that I think are very important. The first is that this doesn't recognize the differential values of different fuels. If you really had a lot of biomass, you have carbon-carbon bonds, the most valuable thing that we now know of to run transportation. Right? And what you would not do with that is you would not naturally take something it could give you with refining, liquid hydrocarbon fuels, and convert it into a far inferior fuel, hydrogen, that then you had to store and transport and use to run your cars, when you could already, in a carbon-neutral fashion, run your cars right off of the biomass-derived liquid hydrocarbon fuel. So if you really had a lot of biomass, we should use that for transportation and not drive hydrogen there. In fact, we should only use hydrogen if we need an energy carrier from renewables or from other sources to drive fixed sites. And yet what we're doing is we're pinning the use of hydrogen on the hardest possible problem, transportation, where is the last case you would economically displace our existing hydrocarbon fuels. In fact, you can make the case that the liquid hydrocarbon fuels are so valuable to fly our planes and run our cars that unless we envision a completely carbon-free economy, which nobody envisions, that we should save our last drop of oil to run our cars and burn it there as opposed to anywhere else. That's the logical conclusion you would come to. Okay? So now I've gotten everybody upset at me, but it's true. Okay. Well, of course, another problem with solar is, and the reason I said that you don't want to make photovoltaics is, you know, a joule is a joule at some point. Right? If I'm making electricity, I can use that at high-value energy when I need electricity, but if I want to heat my house, I don't want to make electricity unless I have to. And the other point is that if you have to do that with electricity right now, if you have to take, say, photovoltaic concentrator cells and then drive them into electrolysis unit, the cost of running the electrolysis unit to make hydrogen from water actually exceeds that 30 cents a kilowatt hour cost to make the electricity from this. So this is the most expensive way you could envision of making hydrogen right now. Furthermore, distributing the electricity is not an inexpensive proposition. We can afford to do it because electricity is high-value energy. But if you think about it, the solar photon energy is worth about 2 EV. Transmission of electricity happens at about 10 kilovolts. We have to step it up. We need inverters, and there are fixed costs associated with that to do that because of otherwise IR losses, right? Whereas chemical fuels are well matched to the solar photon flux because chemical bonds are worth about an EV. The other way to think about it is, when you go to the gas pump and you fill your car up, if you do the calculation, you'll see that you're filling that up at a rate through a 5-buck plastic pipe at about 10 megawatts. That's the power delivered in the enthalpy delivered per unit time of putting liquid hydrocarbon fuel into your car. The other way to think about it is that cars are about a 100 kilowatt power plant, and you fill them up in about a hundredth of the time that you discharge them, so obviously the ratio gives you a filling rate of 100 times more, so you're filling them up at about 10 megawatts. Right? If you want to transmit electricity of 10 megawatts, you can't do that through a 5-buck piece of plastic pipe. Okay? And so you can see that distribution costs and storage costs are much greater for pumping electricity around than they are for pumping fuel around. And so you would never probably get to a reasonable cost basis unless you made fuel on site. So our vision for that is you never have the wires, you never have the inverter, you never pay the penalty to transmit that electricity up to 10 kilovolts. You instead electrolyze water on site right there. But in fact, the better vision is that the only system that's well matched to naturally taking the CO2 from the air and fixing it back into hydrocarbon-based fuels is the ones that plants use. And you can do that over the same area match. So you could, in fact, take CO2 to methanol right in the same flux as you did instead of hydrogen. The point here is that if you make hydrogen, hydrogen plus CO2 is a downhill reaction to make methanol. And you would almost certainly envision rather taking that hydrogen and making methanol out of it in a carbon-neutral cycle and pumping a liquid fuel to the end user than trying to distribute a gaseous fuel, because the viscous losses and everything else involved with the gas is fuel. That's completely a carbon neutral cycle. Methanol is essentially liquid hydrogen. So why would we use a hydrogen economy? Well, I've touched on that. By all measures, physically, hydrogen is an inferior transportation fuel to liquid hydrogens. It's a gas. Its energy density is less than that in specific energy and in volumetric energy by a factor of 5 to 10 than that of hydrogen, even if you could, liquid hydrocarbon fuels, even if you could store it at 10% by volume, you're still paying a 4-fold penalty in the energy contained compared to what you can do with gasoline, and so your cars just can't run as far based on physics. You would say you do for local air quality, but that's a red herring. 90% of the benefits could be obtained right now if we wanted to switch to clean diesel, tier 2 so-called diesel that's low sulfur. Getting the sulfur out of diesel is for diesel fuel what getting the lead out of gasoline was for emissions in gasoline. It enabled catalytic converters on the tailpipe. And getting the sulfur out of diesel actually lets you get the particulates and put catalytic converters on the back. This is proven technology. 50% of new cars sold in Europe already are diesel. The emissions are quoted in many cases to be as clean out the backside or cleaner out the backside than the air that came in the front side. And we could do this now if we so chose, for incremental costs. It's a big cost in an absolute dollar term, but small compared to anything else you would think about for energy. So we'd clean up local air quality without going to hydrogen. We are driven absolutely to go to hydrogen if you envision sequestration. Because if you're going to sequester your fossil energy base and use it, then as I've said, you can only pump protons or electrons, and then you're forced to go to a hydrogen and use economy, and none of the costs I showed you of sequestration included the cost of conversion of the entire infrastructure to handle the distribution and end use of hydrogen. Okay? The third one is renewables, and you're not driven to a hydrogen economy if you do that. Because I've said, if you can close the loop, CO2 and hydrogen, if you made it on site, or electrolysis of water on site, or photoelectrolysis, can be used to fix the CO2 from the air to make the liquid fuel that can be refined to dimethyl ether, which is already a good cooking fuel, run your cars off of methanol, for instance, or dimethyl ether, or can refine it into gasoline, and we wouldn't need to change the end-use infrastructure. This is completely carbon neutral because although you emit CO2, you fix it back again at the beginning. So in fact, you can envision a scenario. BP is already very interested in taking methane and converting it to methanol. Why would that be? They have tremendous reserves of stranded natural gas in Alaska, for instance, that it's so cheap to produce that the best thing to do is just put it back in the ground because it's difficult to pump a gas in a pipeline, and they'd rather convert it to a liquid if they could economically and pump the liquid in a pipeline and then use it. And so methanol is essentially at an energy penalty liquid methane, but it's also liquid hydrogen. Because hydrogen plus CO2 is a liquid methanol also. And this is less energy penalty than that. So it's not clear at all that you'd be driven to a hydrogen economy with renewables. And it's not necessary. We'd have to do a lot of chemistry. What is clear is I think there's almost no doubt. I've heard some people say we can conserve our way out of this problem. I don't think so. I don't think the case is compelling enough that we could conserve so much, the base is just simply too high, right? Furthermore, if you do this and you maintain the base close to where it is now, and you say we have flat energy consumption, what does that do? Carbon emissions are cumulative on the time scale we're talking about. It takes about 200 years for the atmospheric CO2 to mix into the oceans and dissipate it, and it's a time scale mismatch problem. So even if we didn't have energy growth in demand, if we only had it flat and we met those optimistic curves with just consumption, that would push the problem out 20 years because it just continues to add up cumulatively. So it's not a 50-year fix with very, very aggressive conservation. It's good to do, and as I've said, you have to do that if you even want to have a chance, but it's not sufficient. And the case for significant and maybe daunting amounts of carbon-free power certainly seems plausible. What are the challenges? I think we, in the real world, there'll never be one energy solution. There will be regional solutions. Some places will use some wind. Some places will use some other renewables. We will maybe decide to use nuclear. I'm agnostic about, as I said, what the mix will be, but I think we should just understand the numbers and the constraints of if we do need to face this problem, what the magnitude of the problem sets the scale of what the solutions have to be. And what you can say, I think, is you can say you can't get to 10 terawatts of carbon-free power without sequestration, without having solar play, because it's the biggest number in the resource base, even though it's the most expensive renewable now. So you better find a way to make it cheap enough that it can play a part, and that's up to material scientists and chemists to try to do. So that's my perspective on where we would go. I've been, I think, pretty balanced in not saying we have to do this. I think R&D should be viewed as a risk mitigation insurance policy. Now, we don't know we have to do any of this yet. In fact, we may never know until we do the experiment and find out, as opposed to doing the modeling. And then the question is, if we do the experiment and it comes out that there is not significant man-made climate-induced changes, we're fine. If we do the experiment and we find out we have to mitigate, then I think we really do need to do something about the R&D to get it in place. You've seen the R&D choices, and I think we as a society should have a discussion about intelligently what we want to do in order to try to face what I think is probably the biggest technological problem that's facing us in the next 50 years. Okay? So with that, thanks for listening. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm sure there will be many, and I'm happy to discuss them.
What is the experiment that you envisage, waging around through the hot summers and the cold winters?
Yeah, and this is the other issue of, you know, so what is the experiment? Climate is always changing, of course. It's constantly changing. The experiment is, in the face of increased greenhouse gas emissions, can we somehow causally relate anthropogenic activities like increased CO2 emissions to observables that we are willing to pay a penalty in order to mitigate against? That's a much more difficult problem than showing the climate is changing. Right? We may not be able to do that until it's so painfully obvious that things are, for instance, clearly the earliest stages in the oceans that will happen are all the coral reefs will die, the most sensitive pH gradient changes in the ocean. Maybe there's not a price we can put on that, and we will just let that happen, if it happens. Maybe there'll be other secondary effects. You could calculate the thermal expansion coefficient of water and just calculate sea level rise just from physics without any argument of a 1 degree mean centigrade change, and it's, I think, 5 feet or something like that. So that's significant. We don't absolutely know that that will happen. All right. We know the carbon emissions, but we don't know from the historical record whether the temperature oscillations in ice cores that correlate with CO2 level changes are leaders or lags. The data don't have enough phase information. In fact, the most recent analysis seems to show that temperature seems to be leading relative to CO2 as opposed to lagging it on the large swings from the Vostok ice cores. So we don't absolutely know that this would compel us to do something on a scale of expenditure that would be commensurate with changing the biggest industry in the world.
Right? Let's go. Give us a perspective on what the reality of direct photon to chemical reactions are in water so that you can actually photochemicalize water into H2 and O2.
Right. Well, that's what I work on. So I've tried to avoid that, to not be kind of parochial about what we do specifically. So we don't know how to do that now. And the argument is that I make is that no naturally occurring material will likely do that, or it would be happening in the oceans already. And we would see hydrogen coming out of the oceans. And so we will have to invent a material that will do that. So then you say, well, do you have good leads to invent such materials? We have such materials that work great on the moon. They work in the ultraviolet, and they're stable. But we don't have them that are well matched to the solar spectrum that are robust terrestrially. That's a materials chemistry and materials science issue to discover such a material or a binary combination of such materials. There are several research groups, not very many, but several working on them. Mine is one of them. But there is nothing that could be implemented into anything other than a small-scale, low-efficiency demonstration at this stage. Does that mean we couldn't do it in 50 years? You can't ever tell. But you're asking to hatch an egg, right? When will I hatch an egg?
Mm-hmm. My question is, why don't you select nuclear fission immediately? You have...
compared to wind, for example, it takes 3,000 windmills, equivalent to one reactor.
Right.
People were laughing at the number of reactors required.
No.
But you need so much of the other things.
Right.
So why, we have a technology that works.
I didn't say we shouldn't do it.
So why shouldn't that be the first choice?
I said I'm technology agnostic about what we as a society choose to do. I also said that if we don't do anything else, that is absolutely going to be the only scalable technology option we will have, right? Now, there should be a issue of, are we willing to sign up to the equivalent project of building 10,000? Now, 10,000, let me be honest, 10,000 was to get the heat generated. Some people say it's 3,000 because you're displacing 3 joules of coal for every joule of electricity that you make from a nuclear power reactor. The 1 gigawatt is the electric power out that I rated. Now, that's not completely fair, because as I said, after some point, a joule is a joule. Right now, you're displacing 3 joules of coal because you're doing it on the margin into the 10% penetration. At some point, if it's your primary source, then it's only count that 1 gigawatt as a gigawatt of joules. So it's somewhere between 3 and 10, maybe 5. So instead of it's one every other day, it's one a week for 50 years. We could technically do that. And I'm personally agnostic about whether or not we decide to do that. But you know, certainly there needs to be a public debate about that. And I can assure you that you will have many people who either rationally or irrationally would not punch that vote to say yes to build a new nuclear reactor once a week for 50 years. But they better do something if they want to address this problem.
It will also solve the hydrogen problem.
problem because with electrolysis.
No, I already told you that that is not a solution, because at 7 cents a kilowatt hour plus an overhead to make hydrogen, you are making hydrogen at 10 times the energy cost that you now pay for gasoline. So you are not solving the problem by doing that. You are solving a different problem. You are providing energy at 10 times more than you now pay, and that is not a viable solution.
Well, I understand, but you want to get rid of the carbon dioxide.
Right.
You've got to do that.
If you want to do that, if you want to have a viable solution that has energy and therefore economic, energy is the economy. I mean, energy is the currency more than the dollar. Right? So if you want to transition to an economy that has the cost of goods in 50 years be on a 10 times more X basis than it is now, then the solution of using pure known technology to take nuclear to electric and then electric to hydrogen, not counting the hydrogen distribution and infrastructure cost, but just on an energy basis cost, I think that's not a solution. We can disagree on that.
So the average nuclear reactor, energy produced by a nuclear reactor in fission is 1 gigawatt, but yeah. Can you say that that will be the analog for an hypothetical fusion reactor?
No. You know, as I said, the scale of fission reactors is driven by a combination of things, but primarily it's point heat source, and you have to have materials that can withstand that, as well as have, of course, insulation against neutron fluxes and other things. It's combination. You could envision building a much larger scale fusion reactor also. You shouldn't discount that possibility, right? But we have to figure out a way to make that happen technically as well as economically, right? And then you can assign, this is all portfolio management, right? There's technical risk and economic risk with any one of these alternatives. And then there's resource-based limitations on some of them that even if there's no technical or economic risk, there's simply not enough hydro to even do on this scale. So you need to fold all those things in to deciding, I'm not going to rule out absolutely that we couldn't do this in part or in whole by fusion, but I think the numbers provide you with a basis to at least each individually come to some investment portfolio that you want to do.
Good point to stop. Let's thank Nate.
Okay. Fun.